The Problem of Evil, Part 2. The second talk in a four-part series was presented by Jack Crabtree on July 13, 2012, as part of Gutenberg College's 2012 Summer Institute, What the Bleep Can We Know? The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
So, we looked at the argument from evil that could be made, stacked up against that, the counter-argument. What it shows is that we really are dealing with, we have a choice to make. We have two premises. They're either true or false, and we have to decide which we think is true and which we think is false of these premises. So what I'm going to do is spend the next significant part of the notes assessing the respective choice of premises here. So first premise, and I'm dividing my assessment of premise one. Premise one is there exists inexcusable evil in created reality. I'm dividing my assessment of that into looking at whether inexcusable evil exists in created reality, and then I move and look at whether there's inexcusable suffering that exists in created reality. And I'm going to treat those differently because, as I will argue, suffering is not necessarily and automatically evil. But so I want to deal with evil as evil, and then we'll look at suffering and the problem of suffering. So assessing premise one, is it obvious that inexcusable evil exists in created reality? There are several factors, I think, that contribute to our perception that it's obvious that inexcusable evil exists, and I want to look at those different factors that kind of steer us in that direction and evaluate those factors one by one. What's the first one? The first factor is a belief that the existence of any evil whatsoever is incompatible with biblical divine determinism. And my contention is that there's a specious assumption that's connected with that belief. The specious assumption is that a good God cannot be the origin of any evil. Well, in fact, that's however much that may on the surface seem like it makes sense, that ultimately doesn't make any sense at all. Of course God could be the origin of evil. God need not be evil to have the resources to create evil. So think about all the other things that God created that God is not. God created yellow, but I don't think anyone would argue that yellow is the essence of who God is. And yet the argument would have it, well, if he doesn't have it as part of his inherent essence, how would he ever come up with the idea? Well, I don't know how he came up with the idea of yellow, but he did, apparently. So God created yellow without being yellow. God created matter without himself being a material being. God is not a material being, but it didn't stop him from having the creative resources to create something that he is not. So clearly God has created all kinds of things that he himself is not. Evil's just one more of those things. He created evil without being evil. And I don't think it takes too much of our imagination to realize that if God has any imagination, then clearly he has the resources in his imagination to simply imagine what would it be like to be the opposite of what I am morally. And what is evil? It's what God is not. But his imagination can create a concept of what he is not without him having to be that thing. So I think that's kind of a pseudo problem. I don't see that. I don't take that problem very seriously. Of course he can be the origin of evil without himself being evil. Any follow-up on that? Okay, a second factor that steers us in the direction of thinking it's obvious that inexcusable evil exists. Our belief that God must be culpable for any evil that he causes his free will creatures to do. So the fact that here we human beings bring all kinds of evil into the world, we do it out of our freedom, but as a divine determinist, I'm saying God makes us do what we do in our freedom. well, it's very common for people to take the perspective, but if he caused us to do it, then he's culpable for it. He's the one who's responsible, not me. Well, the specious assumption here is that if God is the ultimate cause of everything, then God is culpable for all the evil done by the free will beings in his creation. That assumption involves a failure to note the very important difference between God being a transcendent cause and God being an ordinary cause of the evil that he determines. I'm going to argue that God is not morally accountable for the evil he causes his creatures to do precisely because he doesn't cause it in the ordinary sense, but rather he is the transcendent cause of evil. So let's look at that. What's the difference between transcendent causation and ordinary causation? Transcendent causation has a different logic from ordinary causation. If God coerces me, Jack, to do an evil act by force, so he's coercing me, or it could be physical coercion, but if it's deceit or manipulation of some kind, in any way, if God is imposing his will upon mine against my will, if you will, he's kind of erasing my will or eclipsing my will with his own will, that's an act of a kind of violence, a kind of coercion. If God did that, then he is to blame, or at least partially to blame, for what I do. But that's what I would call ordinary causation. See, that's the only way we can influence each other. The only way you could make me do evil is by coercing me somehow. Manipulation, deception, lying to me, physically coercing me, bribing me, blackmailing me. By using some kind of coercive tactic, you might be able to get me to do your will, not my will. And we recognize that in that case, you share in the culpability for what I've done. If, in fact, you're not totally to blame, you at least share in the blame for that. Well, that's how we imagine what God is doing. We imagine that God is imposing his will upon us through some kind of method of coercion. And he's eclipsing my will and replacing my will with his own will. And because we imagine him doing that, we then go, well, he's to blame then. I'm not to blame, he's to blame. But that's because we're thinking of it along the lines of our ordinary concept of causation in the world. What I'm arguing, though, is that that's not what God does. God does not coerce me into doing what he wants me to do. He creates me as a being who freely wants to do what I want to do. When he creates me to freely want to do what I want to do, he's creating me to freely want to do what he wants me to want to do. But that's as someone outside of reality who doesn't need to coerce, because he has a power that none of us have. From his standpoint as the transcendent author of all reality, all he has to do is say, let Jack want to murder, and Jack will want to murder. And it's important. Let Jack want to murder, and Jack wants to murder. We have to take that seriously. Jack wants to murder. He is freely choosing it. It is me. It is my will that I'm giving expression to. It is me that I am expressing in my act of murder. I'm choosing to murder because I'm a murderer. But all that's true. Granted, there's a creator of all reality who created that, who brought that into being, but that's what he brought into being through his creative act, is a murderer who wants to murder freely and voluntarily out of his own will.
A playwright.
A playwright.
Creates a character.
That's right.
J.K. Rowling being held responsible for only more killing more people.
Exactly. Yeah, it would make no sense.
Yeah.
But God is accountable and responsible if the story he's telling turns out to be an evil story.
Yeah, we'll get there. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so you grasp the distinction I'm making between ordinary causation and transcendent causation and how they have a different logic to them. Like Bill and Alan were saying, we would never apply the logic of ordinary causation to the author of a novel, for example, or a playwright writing a play. We would never blame the playwright for the things the characters do in the play. We would never blame an author for the things the characters in the novel do. That would make absolutely no sense at all.
And the same, if we were to bring the characters out of the novel, we wouldn't blame them for their actions.
Exactly.
In the transcendent reality.
Exactly, yeah. If those characters could ever be magically transformed and become peers of the author, then it would be ridiculous for the author to blame them in his reality, in that plane of reality, for what they did within the story. That would be ridiculous. Okay?
Jeff, did you blame authors like for gratuitous violence, mm-hmm. or so dial that into your problem?
I think my argument will dial that in, okay. is one of the cases could be made is, okay, this is a story, and yeah, you created that, and you're not to blame for that, but this is a story that contains way too much of that. And that would be a valid indictment of God. So it's wrong to pass judgment upon God on account, I'm on the top of page 5b, it is wrong to pass judgment upon God on account of his creative causation of evil deeds as if that creative causation were ordinary and not transcendent causation. God, the transcendent author, is not culpable for the evil deeds his creatures do. Hence, God is not to blame for all the evil that human beings do in this reality. His moral character cannot be judged by the deeds of his characters. And then C, it is a common mistake to think that committing an evil act and transcendently causing, creating an evil act, are morally equivalent. Because they're not. To create evil is not the same thing as doing and being evil. One can create evil and yet be a good person. Thus, a novelist could be a good person and create a novel with characters doing evil things. I mean, ask yourself the question, could the morally perfect Jesus have written a novel? He was busy. I don't know if he had time. But could he have written a novel that contained evil, deep choices in it? I don't know why not. You wouldn't turn around and say, no, I'm sorry. He was the perfect human being. He was morally flawless. He can't write novels.
He told parables with people.
He did, exactly. He told parables with people who did unjust acts in them. Exactly. Good point.
So,
and we don't blame Jesus for that.
So would you say... For somebody to say, ask the question like you were asking, is it immoral to cut somebody's abdomen open? If we replace that act with, is it immoral to be the cause of a murder, either by being a murderer or by being the transcendent God writing the murder into his story? You'd have to say, well, I need more information.
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly what I'm saying. To just say to cause somebody to do that, that doesn't adequately characterize.
Or be the origin of that that act. You have to say, how am I the origin of that act?
Exactly. So note that the presence of evil characters and evil deeds in a novel do not entail that the novelist is evil. Point two, to evaluate the creation of an evil act, one must determine the following. A, was the act necessary to the narrative of which it is a part? If it's gratuitous, this comes to Robbie's question, if it is gratuitous, that is to say, it could have been left out and nothing about the meaning and significance of the story would have been affected by it. It's just evil that's there just to be evil. Then that would be a problem. Gratuitous evil is morally problematic in a story. And then B, and is the narrative of which it is a part a narrative that ought to have been created in the first place? Is it a good story, a morally appropriate and worthy story? So when I use good story from here on out, it's going to have two meanings packed into one. One, it's morally appropriate, so it's morally good, but it not just isn't morally appropriate, but should it exist? Does it have whatever the goodness is that attaches to a story, that it's the kind of story that ought to have been created rather than the story that it ought to have never been imagined. I mean both of those things by a good story. So God's telling a story, and within that story he's creating evil acts by evil people. We have to ask of those evil acts that he created two things. One, were they necessary to the story? Did they contribute to the goodness of the story? Meaningfully, substantially contribute to the goodness of the story? If not, then it's morally questionable whether that act ever should have been created. But then secondly, even if you could make the case that, no, this did substantially contribute to the goodness of the story as a story, so I can see why that's in that story. But then you have to step back and ask a second question. But the story of which it's a part, should that ever have come into existence? Was it worth being? Because if it was not worth being, it's morally questionable whether the author is good. Why would a good being bring into existence a story that has evil in it, and the story is of such a nature it never should have been created?
If it glorifies evil.
Yeah, for example, if it glorifies evil.
But can we ever judge that, though?
That my argument is going to be no way. Exactly.
Yeah. We haven't finished reading the story, though. We haven't finished reading the story.
Right, and that's one of the reasons we can't judge that, is that that could never be judged until you get to the end of the story. And who of us is at the end of the story, such that we've seen how all the storylines are resolved and come together, such that we can even be in a position to pass that kind of judgment. We don't know that. Okay, point C. Belief that a good and worthy reality, a good narrative, would contain no evil whatsoever. And this sounds very similar to the first one, but I'm giving a different answer to it, so it's a shade different than the first one about God being the origin of evil. In this one, the specious assumption is that a good creation, we're specifically looking at it as a narrative now, a good creation, a good narrative, is made evil just to the extent that it contains evil deeds within it. Well, again, of course that's a specious assumption. We look at all kinds of stories and narratives that we would consider to be good stories and good narratives, and it's a good thing that they exist, that contain evil deeds within them. So obviously that assumption cannot be right. So the mere fact that evil is present in a story doesn't make it a bad story, an evil story. In fact, a good created reality or narrative may very well contain evil deeds within it, if in fact those evil deeds are necessary to the meaning of the narrative, and therefore of the worthiness of the narrative, or the worthiness of created reality. An occurrence can be meaningful and can contribute to a good story, even if the occurrence itself is evil. I don't think that's all that problematic, because we've read enough novels that we know that that's true. As the author of the story of reality, God cannot rightly be judged by the moral nature of each and every occurrence within the story. He can only rightly be judged by the worthiness of the story itself taken as a whole. Because God is not creating isolated acts. See, that's why it's so important to see the narrative structure of reality. We can't just take an isolated act, disconnect it from the narrative it's a part of, and look at that and say, God created that. Wow, what an evil duty must be. He didn't create that. He created the story. And the story has all kinds of interlocking parts that weave together in a way that give it meaning as a whole. And it's the whole that God is creating, not merely the parts. So if we're going to judge the goodness of God, we have to judge him by what he actually is creating. And what he actually is creating is an entire, whole, complete, meaningful, coherent narrative.
So would that be like, or seeing a video of somebody rushing up and shoving someone and they fall on the ground and you say, that's reprehensible. Mm-hmm. And then you look at the first part of the video and discover there's a bus coming at this person, and it was the only way to put your mind.
Exactly. And I think Tim will be talking about, if I caught what he's going to be talking about, we'll be talking some more about narrative tonight. Alistair MacIntyre in his book Beyond Virtue has a chapter on, he's not talking about reality, he's talking about individual identity, but the point that he makes in that chapter is that individual identity can only finally be understood and defined by being the protagonist of a narrative, basically. What makes the individual they are? They're in that story, at the center of that story. And he makes a very compelling case for that. And that's been very influential on me, because that was implicit in the conclusion of my book, The Most Real Being. It was implicit, but I had never really grasped how significant that was. And MacIntyre helped me grasp that.
So why isn't the argument that we have to judge it by the whole book? Are we making an end justifies the means argument there? Why is
no, it's not, because it's not that the evil is a means to some end. See, we've already stopped thinking of it as a narrative when we make it a means to an end. It's not that it's the means to the end. It's an inherent, intrinsic component of the goodness of the whole that God is creating. And that's different. It's organically related to the whole, not instrumentally related to an end.
That it needs to be seen and understood in its context rather than as an isolated object.
That's right.
Just as in a painting or whatever, you can't look at just one line, you have to look at the whole picture or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Again, Principia Ethica by G.E. Moore has a whole discussion of what he calls organic wholes, and that it's a terrible book, but he has a lot of great ideas. I mean, there's a lot about it that I really, really don't like, but there are several points he makes along the way that I think are very insightful, and one of them is his whole concept of an organic whole and the logic of an organic whole. It's not a means to end kind of relationship. Okay. So remember divine determinism insists on the narrative structure of reality, and therefore that God is to be judged by the moral quality of the grand, sweeping, overarching narrative that he's creating, and not by the moral nature of any particular occurrence, and not by the outcome of any given creature's existence. I'm anticipating a point I'm going to make later, but it's also, how do we judge God? Not by whether my life goes well. You know, if I sink into misery in my existence, I would not be justified in going, God is evil, because I'm miserable. It's not about me. And so if I can be detached enough from my own existence to actually think objectively and philosophically about the question, then at the level of philosophy, okay, so my life ends in misery. That's how Satan's is going to end, is in misery. Does that mean God is evil? No, quite to the contrary. Satan is going to deserve whatever misery he gets. And when you put it in the context of the coherent whole that he's creating, it's going to make sense. It's going to be coherent. And it's going to be a story that is worth telling. So what he needs to be judged by, God needs to be judged by, is the whole that he's creating, which is a narrative, not any given isolated act or aspect of that whole.
So that's just a bit of a rabbit trail, but if you're dealing with someone who has been a victim of great injustice, such as a victim of child sexual abuse, as an adult, wrestling with the idea, how can I possibly trust a God who chose this for me? That answer isn't going to work, I can say from personal experience, and probably the counselors in the room have got some better ideas of how you deal with somebody who has.
Yeah, it's important to recognize, I'm not answering the question, how should you cope with the suffering in your life? I'm not answering that question. That's a different question. I'm dealing with the philosophical argument from evil that is making the philosophical case that we should not believe in divine determinism because evil exists in the world. That's what I'm answering. So now later I'm going to say some things that will have some relevance to the issue of how you might cope with evil and suffering in your life, but that's not my primary focus, and that's a great question because it's important to distinguish those issues. They're not the same thing. Exactly.
clear?
Because okay. it seems rather heartless to say to someone in the midst of their misery, get over it, it's not about you.
Yeah, and also to kind of naively, as I had expect that if I explain all this to this person who is still in psychic shock over what he experienced as a child, to expect to be able to glibly go in there and express, do all this philosophy, which he's very sophisticated in, but it's still in, there's this pain in it. The philosophy is not going to get into it.
Now, I would argue this is part of the therapy.
Yeah.
This has to be part of the therapy because it's having a right grasp of reality that gives me the context within which I can resolve everything else personally. If you don't have this perspective, I don't know how you can resolve it. But this is just one of the pieces. It's not, it, like you say, it's not get your philosophy right and everything is fine.
Yeah.
Okay. I think B, at the bottom of five there, B, God can be judged to be evil if and only if the story ought not to have been created, and or the evil within which it is, like the evil within it is not necessary to its intrinsic meaning. So evil would be absurd, gratuitous, and therefore absurd if it didn't contribute to the meaning, meaningfully to the meaning of the narrative, and it would be evil of God to have created a reality that should never have existed. Then we can judge God, but we're judging him appropriately by the right standard, namely, we're judging him for what he actually did create, not for something within it that is isolated and detached and disconnected, fragmented from what he created.
So would you say that God's creation of this book, this reality, is actually an act of ordinary creation from his perspective? Because it's in his mind?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't... It's from our perspective that it's transcendent, in other words, is what you're saying.
The reason we can hold him accountable for this creation is that he created it ordinarily. He didn't transcendently create it. It's since he had an idea, just like we have ideas.
Exactly. It's a creator being a creator. It's a mind being a mind. It's a thinker thinking a thought. Exactly. And that's part of the divine determinism. I am not ashamed to say we are figments of God's imagination. I think that's profoundly true. Now, the problem most people have with that is, well, if we're a figment of God's imagination, then we're not real. Well, no, that doesn't follow. We're as real as we ever thought we were. It's just that we're not as real as the mind of God. Because we are dependent upon the mind of God. He must will us. He must act in order for us to exist. We can't exist by ourselves. Always. We will always and forever. See, that's the difference between a more traditional Christian worldview that sees us as being temporarily inferior to God, creatures, but then we're going to die and go to heaven and then we'll be like God.
So
we won't.
Is that what you said before, that we may never see God, we'll see Jesus.
That's right.
I call him, but we will never see him because we never equal out on the playing field.
That's right. We will never be his equal, never be his peer. No one has seen God at any time, and we could add, and never will, in the sense that he means that. Okay, see, God can create free will creatures who choose to do evil. God can choose. God can create free will creatures who choose to do evil without himself? That makes no sense.
Without himself being evil.
Oh, there we go. That's pretty bad when I can't even execute my own. God can create free will creatures who choose to do evil without himself as the author of it all being evil for having created them. If the overall story he created is a worthwhile story, and if it's morally permissible to have created it. It is no more evil for God to have created evil human beings who do evil things than it is for a novelist to have created evil characters who do evil things. A story can be good, and by that I mean meaningful, significant, worthy, something that ought to exist, even while it contains evil beings doing evil, ugly, harmful things. The author of a story must be judged by the worthiness and goodness of the story as a whole. The evil acts contained in the story make a necessary and significant contribution to the meaning and significance of the story. Then their presence does not mean that the author is evil. That is, if they do, then the author is not evil. If the story is worthy, then anything God creates is good to the extent that it contributes meaningfully to the meaning and significance of the overall story. God can create a morally evil event without being evil himself, insofar as the evil event he created contributes to a morally good story. An evil deed within created reality does not necessarily make reality itself evil. I'm just hammering that point home that I hope has been grasped already. Is that clear? So, is God culpable for the evil things that we do in our freedom in this? Well, no, not unless he makes us do it gratuitously, or not unless reality itself stinks so bad that it never should be good.
Does the story have to be morally good or transcendently good? And is there a difference? I mean, I think there probably is a difference, but...
Well, I think it would have to be morally...
I can see a transcendently good story. One of the characteristics of it would be morally good.
Yes.
But morally good doesn't encompass the whole of transcendently good.
Okay, I guess I'm not sure what your category of transcendently good exactly is. Whatever it is, I think the answer is yes, but I'm having trouble getting my mind around what that concept is.
And so am I. I guess I'm ascribing the adjective morally good, morally to good, seems as though I'm making a judgment on it. And I don't think that, I think we said earlier, I don't think that we have the ability to make a judgment about the goodness of the story.
Okay, yes.
It is, in God's reality, good.
Yes.
In our reality, we have no way to judge if it's morally good or not.
Yes.
And I guess morally good I ascribe to our plane of existence rather than transcendently.
Okay, I would think that it could be in both planes of existence. That
morally good is?
Yeah, but okay. Our concept of good could be applied at both planes. So by transcendently good, you mean good from a transcendent perspective.
Yes.
And yeah, absolutely. It's going to be good from a transcendent perspective. It's not that it's not good from my perspective, but as you point out, and in fact this is the whole heart of my argument really, is that from my perspective, I can't know.
Yeah.
But it can only be known from a transcendent perspective, finally and ultimately, whether it's good or it isn't good.
Okay, yeah, that's kind of what I
where
it's going.
So where I'm going in this argument is where we are left is we don't have a standpoint from which we can pass judgment on whether created reality is or is not good. But what we can do from where we stand is we can have some hints and suggestions that the author of reality is good. And because the author of reality is good, we can therefore assume that the story he's telling will ultimately be good when it reaches its resolution, which we will never be there to see. And the reason I'm saying that is because we're always going to be in it. There's always going to be a future. So it will never, ever be resolved in a way that I will know its resolution. That is inherently impossible. That's your point, I think, is that only God has the perspective from which he knows the Alpha from the Omega, the beginning from the end, so entirely and so completely that he can pass judgment on it. I can't do that. But I do have reason to know the moral character of the author of that.
We do?
That's what I will argue. Yeah.
Okay.
Jack, don't we know that the end result, or won't we know the end result in the age to come when the kingdom of God is here in its fullest and there will be no more evil?
Yeah, I mean, it may very well be that we'll see enough of the end that we could... maybe we would have a good basis for assuming that created reality is good. But the point I'm making is, the logical point is, if all of created reality is a story, we never come to the end of the story, because the eternal kingdom of God is a story that keeps going.
But even though we don't know the future, we know that it's going to again, it's an assumption that it will continue.
Exactly. Because what if in the end Satan comes back as resurrected and wrecks everything?
Oops. I'm just tired of it.
If the story ends, we end, so how can we?
I'm sorry?
If the story ends, we end.
Exactly. Well, that's true. Right. So we can never know. But see, that's going to be critical to my whole point. That there's a difference between accepting the premise that there is no inexcusable evil, because I can look at reality and I go, there's no inexcusable evil there. How could I know that? And there might be. That's different from saying, I can't look at reality and tell you that, but I know the author. I know the one who's making all this stuff, and I have this reason, this reason, this reason, and this reason to have confidence that the author is good. So I'm betting there ain't no inexcusable evil in reality. That would be inconsistent with the character of the author of this thing. That's going to be the gist of my argument.
This might be just a variation on the theme of, we know the author is good, so we expect the book to be good. But could we see enough of what's happening, especially given what we're told is going to happen, to deduce the reason God wrote the story, which was, as somebody was talking about, creating a stage for his son to play a particular role. And we see that this role that he's playing, some of which we have seen, already seen, and some of which we have yet to see, but we've got enough of the idea, this is a story that should have been written.
Mm-hmm. And I think in broad themes, that's exactly what we're going to know. And I think that's sort of Paul's point. We get to the kingdom of heaven, and now we've seen, in large part, a resolution of many of these huge central themes to the story, such that we go, that's a good...
I'm glad the story was
written. Exactly.
It's a very long ending.
Yeah, it's a very long ending.
Very long last chapter.
So... in the end, God's creation is a literary faux pas, but come on, God, resolve it. Get to the end.
No, don't get to the end.
Okay, where are we? So D, belief that I have a, and we've already been talking about this then, belief that I do have a standpoint from which I can make a valid judgment that the evil I see is meaningless and or unnecessary. We readily take on that assumption. Yeah, I'm in a position where I can look out there and I can decide whether the evil and suffering out there is meaningless or unnecessary or absurd or whatever. Well, really? That's a specious assumption that I can know whether an evil event is necessary. I have no standpoint from which I can see that if I accept that created reality is a narrative. See that, and that's why that's so critical to my argument. Because if I take the position that what happens, the events in life, are these discrete, self-contained units, then okay, I saw the whole event. And I saw the whole event, and I can define the whole event, and it was evil. And it was unnecessary, it was absurd. I see nothing coming out of that. I see nothing good coming out of that event. Well, that's what we think. But partly, we're taking the perspective, ignoring the perspective that what God is creating is a narrative. And it's not detached, discrete, unconnected with other things in the world. And it's only by tracing all the connections with everything else that I would ever be in a position to decide, was it a necessary part of the story as a whole? And once I begin to see that, and once I recognize how many storylines there are in reality, not just human, but animals and subatomic particles and all that kind of stuff, when I look at the vast, infinite number of storylines, how on earth could I ever presume that I'm in a position to pass judgment on how this fits and whether or not it was necessary? How could I possibly know that? So, but when we ignore our lacking that standpoint, it's very easy for us to be kind of glib and make a facile assumption that, well, I'm a big boy. I can decide whether something was necessary or not. No, I can't. I don't have that kind of perspective. In fact, we lack an adequate perspective from which we can claim to know such a thing. We don't have a perspective from which to know the ultimate and final meaning of any particular event within reality. The story's not over, and the story is bigger than anything that I can see, I should add. I do not have a standpoint from which I can claim to evaluate from my own standpoint whether the story of created reality is worthwhile and therefore morally permissible. That was Paul's point. It's only from a transcendent perspective that I could ever really know whether the reality that God is creating ought to have existed. And I don't have that transcendent standpoint. Contrary to fact, we would have to know the whole story of all of created reality in order to know such a thing. Okay. Fifth point. Belief that I have a standpoint from which I can make a valid judgment that the evil that exists in the world is excessive. And this is the question that Robbie brought up earlier. Even if I could bring myself to accept that everything that exists in reality is meaningful, nonetheless, it's still possible that, yes, it's a meaningful story. It's a story of meaningful parts that are all interconnected in a coherent and meaningful way, but it still is a reality that ought not to have existed just simply because there's just too much evil. Some stories might be very meaningful, but the amount of evil in them just has gone over the threshold of whatever should have been created. Logically, you could take that position. And I think there are a lot of people who that's the belief they have, is that, okay, yeah, I don't know whether it was meaningful or not or necessary or not or whatever, but there's a whole lot of evil in the world, and from the amount of evil that I see, I just think there's too much. A good God never would have brought that into existence. Okay, again, do I have a standpoint from which I can make that judgment? There's a specious assumption that a human being could know when the amount of evil in the world is excessive. I just think, honestly, if I face into my finiteness, I need to recognize, of course I don't know from my standpoint whether that's true. It could only be known from a transcendent standpoint. In fact, we lack an adequate perspective from which we can claim to know such a thing. Contrary to fact, we would have to know the whole story of all of created reality and know it from the inside. We do know it from the inside, but we should know it from the inside. And know it from the inside in order to know such a thing. That I'll spell that out a little bit more when we start talking about suffering. Much of the meaning of evil and suffering in the world is what's transpiring inwardly in people's lives. And I don't know that. I can't know that. I can know that for myself, but I can't know that for other people. And when we talk about the excessive evil in the world, rarely are we talking about my own suffering. We're talking about all that evil out there.
And I might not even know it for myself, all that's going on in the world.
Absolutely. You mean my own suffering? Exactly. Absolutely. Okay. Sixth, belief that created reality is not good and worthwhile if its outcome for me or for any other creature of interest to me is not beneficial to me or for that other creature. This is a very, very common, I think, mistaken assumption, a fallacious assumption, that we are to judge whether or not creation ought to have existed by whether the creatures in reality benefit. Now, the creatures we're almost always interested in are me and the people I love. I mean, we're quite willing to accept anonymous people somewhere in the world suffering, getting killed, and starving to death, and that kind of stuff. But that better not touch me. And if it touches me and the people I love, then we're prepared to, you know, raise our fist at God and say, "This never should have come into existence." Well, remember what Jesus said about Judas. it would have been better for him if he had never been born. Yes, the outcome for individual and particular creatures is not always going to be good for them. But does that make created reality evil just because there are creatures within it where it would have been better if they had never been born? That doesn't follow philosophically. A specious assumption is that a good created reality must necessarily result in a good outcome for any and every creature, at least any and every creature of concern to me. Since there are many bad outcomes for many creatures of concern to me, then created reality is unnecessarily evil, is how we reason. But in fact, a perfectly good created reality, in a perfectly good created reality, the outcome of any particular creature may not be a beneficial one for that particular creature. Whether what God creates is morally good is not rightly determined by whether any particular created being benefits from his existence. An ultimately harmful outcome to one of God's creatures, the classic example, of course, is Satan. An ultimately harmful outcome to one of God's creatures does not make reality itself evil. The story of created reality and each individual storyline within it is good, right, and worthy to the extent that it reflects something meaningful, significant, and true about its morally good author, God. So you see how important it is, the point I was making earlier. The story God is creating is not for and about me, it's for and about him. That statement gets repeated a number of times in the New Testament. All things that exist were brought into existence for God, with a view to God, for the sake of God, about God. That statement gets made about God, and that statement gets made about Jesus, but it never gets made about me.
In this, when Paul says all things work to the good to those who love God and called according to his purpose, one might say that God is still in focus there. It's our relationship to God that's significant as to whether things work out to the good for us.
That's right.
But at the same time, the fact that we love God means all things do work out for the good for us. It's just that he did this for us in relationship with him.
Right. But we're a unique class of God's creatures. We are those who love God and are called according to his purpose.
Which are the same thing.
Yeah.
People who love God have been called according to his
right.
purpose.
That's right. But we're a unique class of God's creatures who that's why we are the elect, the chosen ones, the holy ones, the set apart ones. We've set apart for this beneficial outcome in our lives. But that's not true of every creature. And there are all kinds of people who respond to that. Well, then God's not good. A good God would not damn anybody out. A good God would not punish people. A good God would not condemn anybody. Well, he would if that's the story. And if that's important and necessary to the story, and a contributing element to the goodness of the story, well, then he would. So, it's contrary to all of those kind of protective instincts in us that want God not to be mean to anybody, not to have anybody be harmed by having brought into existence. And those are wonderful instincts, but they make lousy philosophical arguments. It doesn't follow, if we really understand who God is and what he's doing, it doesn't follow that God would not create a creature precisely for the sake of bringing him harm in the end. That's exactly what the Son of Perdition was. Someone who was brought into existence to make the most central act of evil and treachery that has ever been committed and go to a harmful end as a result of that. I think that's how to read the Son of Perdition.
Could we stretch God's perception of good with the distinction that is that which is created reaches its ultimate purpose?
I think that's true. That was what was remarkable in the Gorgias' passage, you know, that his concept of good as being ordered and purposive, and I can't remember all the other language he used, but there's something very insightful about what Socrates is saying there, is that there's something meaningful and good about just being what you're supposed to be, fitting into things the way you're supposed to fit into things. It's not about pleasure that Socrates is saying. It's not the fact that you're being pleased that is the good. It's the fact that you're right. That you're the right kind of person in the right kind of relationship with the right kind of reality and have the right kind of attitude about it. There's a reward, a blessing attached to that that is not like our ordinary sense of happiness and pleasure and all those other rather superficial measures that we make of our existence. I mean, that's what I love about that dialogue, is Socrates is saying, I'd rather be right than happy. I'd rather be right than protected from misery, sin, pain, and injustice. Treat me unjustly, but let me be good. Let me be right. Let me be well-ordered, even if all around me is victimizing. There's something really deeply profound about that, and I think that's very much in sync with the biblical perspective. Was I getting your point, or was I changing?
You were sort of getting the point, and you added to the point, which is in depth, and that's why I appreciate it. I was mostly coming from the perspective of perfection, as you defined it to us, as not being perfect in all choices, but reaching the oak to the oak tree.
Yes.
And so even if an individual's role is condemnation, they do ultimately fulfill that purpose. And so from God's point of view, I was wondering if we could stretch that to say that is good. And so in this case, we could use good to be the definition of perfect.
Yeah, I think so. Okay. At least it certainly includes that. It may be broader than that, but it certainly includes that. And that has an important implication. I think what Socrates is saying in that dialogue, I think what the biblical perspective is if I came to terms with the reality that my role in God's story was to go to my condemnation, what would it be like to look at that and go, oh, okay, that's good. That's right. That's what I need to do. I need to go to my condemnation. Well, the irony in the biblical perspective is anybody who can have that attitude toward it is not going to go to their condemnation.
Yeah, that's what I was drawing to.
Exactly.
Coming to accept what part of this is,
exactly,
irrespective of whatever situations occur within the temple, just coming to rest in
that. And it's that kind of humble, gentle acceptance that God is the creator and I am the creature and I want to be whatever he wants me to be. I think that's what, in that dialogue, Socrates called, they translated as temperance, which is a terrible translation. But I think that's the virtue that he's grasping there. There really are two kinds of human beings. They're those people who bang their fist against the wall and are restless and restive and kind of that wild rebelliousness against God. God, who do you think you are? I don't have to be what you want me to be. I want to be what I want to be. You can't make me. And if you condemn me, damn you. There's that kind of person. And then there's the person who goes, you're the creator. I'm the creature. This is a good story. It's important that I be in the story what you want me to be in the story. And whatever the outcome for me, why don't we have your will be done? Why don't we have your script play out and not me ad-lib anything? That's the other kind of person. That second kind of person, the one who has sophrosune, is the one who has promised a blessing. The other one is committing the unforgivable sin. There is no mercy for the one who never gets past himself and can lay his rebellion aside and go, God, you're the creature. And what else am I going to do except submit to you? You're the creator. And what else am I going to do but submit to you?
So fundamentally, this the rebellion, the rebel, wants to be God.
Yeah, yeah. wants to script his own existence.
It's exactly. Basically what it's saying.
It's exactly. Yes, yes, exactly. To be like God in deciding for myself what ought to be and what ought not to be in my life. Exactly. I think that's right. Okay. Let's press on here. So to, in fact, in a perfectly good created reality, the outcome for any particular creature may not be a beneficial one. Whether what God creates is morally good or is not rightly determined by whether any particular creature benefits. There's Satan, there's Judas. B, the story of created reality and each individual storyline within it is good, right, worthy to the extent that it reflects something meaningful, significant, and true about the morally good author of God. So it's not about me. The purpose of the particular storyline that God is creating, centered in me, is to bring glory to Him, not to bring benefit to me. The goodness and worthiness of any given storyline is not dependent upon whether its resolution benefits any particular actor within the storyline. If one rejects this perspective on God and reality, then there is no answer to the problem of evil, it seems to me. If we don't understand that it's for God, then if we think that every creature and the people important to me need to benefit, I promise you there's no answer to the story of evil, because they're not going to benefit as much as you think they ought to. It just isn't going to happen. The nature and extent of evil in the world just is incompatible with God being good in the sense that He is a creator who desires to bring benefit to each and every one of His creatures. If this is how we insist on defining good, then God is not good. Period. This fact about God and created reality is the most significant stumbling block, I think, within the biblical worldview. And I'm just going to read this section. It's not, I think it's pretty self-explanatory. We strongly resist the idea that reality is absolutely theocentric, that is, God-centered, in the way that I've just described. We naturally gravitate toward a creature-centric, and especially a me-centric perspective. Namely, if I do not benefit by my existence, then it's not good that God created me. If my story does not end well for me, then I ultimately benefit, that my story cannot be judged to be a good one. There are five important but offensive implications of the above fact. 1. God did not create reality to bring benefit to me. He created reality to reflect who He is. B, by the very nature of who God is and what created reality is, God is fully within His rights to use me to fulfill whatever purposes He chooses. If those purposes are good, then God is good, regardless of whether the outcome is good for me. It's wrong for me to use you, but that's because we're equals, we're peers. But what else is a creator to do except use his creation for his purposes? That's what makes God God. C, the moral goodness of God is found in the moral goodness of the story of reality as a whole. It is not found in whether he brings benefit to me and mine. D, creating me does not obligate God to bring me benefit. God can be perfectly good and at the same time bring nothing but harm to me. That'd be entirely possible. And then finally, E, if I concede that God is under no obligation to benefit me, then in the end I will be given an end that benefits me. But if I insist that God is under obligation to benefit me, then in the end I will not be given an end that benefits me. To not come to know God in that way is the unforgivable sin. Okay, 2. In actual fact, as the above considerations show, it is not obvious that inexcusable evil exists in created reality. We do not have a standpoint from which we could possibly claim to know that the evil we see in reality is inexcusable. I'd have to have a transcendent standpoint, and I don't have that standpoint, and I never will have that standpoint. So I just simply don't have a standpoint from which I can claim to know there's inexcusable evil in the world. If we were to judge created reality from our own vantage point, or to draw no inferences from what we can know about the character of its creator, and were to judge simply on the basis of the story that created reality is itself, we would justly have to remain agnostic with regard to whether it contains any inexcusable evil. unless and until we can see how the story of reality ultimately and finally resolves itself, then we have no basis from which to know whether the evil we see in the present is meaningful and necessary, or not meaningful and not necessary. The what? The
obligation or lack thereof.
Uh-huh.
I think I understand what you're saying. God is not obligated to provide me a pleasant life or a pleasant outcome to my life. I'm not sure that translates into God has no obligation to me. He created me in His image. He didn't have to do that. I am different from a rock. I think there's a certain, the same kind of logic that requires me to love you may also be operative in terms of God loving. Loving us, basically. And by love, I don't mean that doesn't translate into necessarily my life being pleasant or having a positive outcome, because the father of the prodigal son loved his son. He might or might not have come back. He nevertheless loved his son, not based on the knowledge that the son would come back, but just because he was his son. And so I think there's something about our imageness that, which was entirely at God's discretion to create us with His image, that He in effect obligated Himself by making us significant beings.
I wouldn't see it that way. I don't think that, I mean, there's something profoundly true in what you're saying, and that is, being made in the image of God, I am objectively worthy for that very reason. I'm an objectively, ontologically good creature, a magnificent creature, a wonderful creature, an honorable creature. I mean, all that can be said, and that's very true. But I think that obligates me to you and you to me.
Right.
I don't think that obligates God to us.
In any respect?
Not really.
Because then I'm left with the question, why does He love us?
What do you think that means, that
well,
He loves us?
It seems to me that the same thing that would make it make sense for God to love us also, in effect, obligates us. And also, if God's love is a consequence of His goodness, that implies that goodness requires love, which implies an obligation based on something, which I assume is our imageness.
We have to make a distinction between when we say that God loves us, what Christian culture has just inculcated in us big time is that what that means is God in some way, God has some kind of attraction to us, some kind of fondness toward us, however we define that. I don't think that's true. God loves Jacob, but He hates Esau. And I think God does not promote my well-being because He's attracted to me. God promotes my well-being because God is a loving God. It's love in a different sense. To love is to be committed to the well-being of something or someone. Does God love us in that sense? Some of us.
Well, that's common. I mean, well-being is, as far as you can go, the well-being of an evil creature is to die. That's one of the points in Gorgias.
Okay.
So, I think God is committed to the well-being of us all. And I suspect it's not attraction. That's kind of a loaded word. I would say recognition of the value, the fact that my image reflects Himself, and He values Himself, so logically He has to value me.
Yeah, and I think that's certainly true. He does value. God does not hide the truth from Himself. That what a magnificent being a human being is, but it didn't stop Him from having His son tortured.
Right.
That be the outcome of
yes.
His life. So, God can recognize the value of Jesus without feeling an obligation to make things go well for Him. That's the point that I'm making. Well, we're about ready to break for lunch. Just 5 minutes. Any other questions on this so far? We're now going to move from evil to suffering in the next section.
Is Satan transcendent?
Sorry.
Is Satan transcendent?
No, no.
So only God.
Only God is transcendent. Yeah, Satan's a creature, a wimpy little creature.
I would call him not wimpy. We're a lot wimpier.
Jesus.
We don't know a lot about Satan. We know more about him in Christian culture than we do in the Bible. The Bible doesn't really give us a lot of information about who this weird, mysterious being is. I'll take it.
Although, isn't there a part where it says somebody didn't presume him to rebuke Satan, but give a railing rebuke that said the Lord rebuke you? The idea that he's a ontologically more significant being than we are, such that, you know, if somebody needs to rebuke him, it's not going to be me, needs to be God.
Yeah. It's in Judah.
If we have no standpoint by which to judge the goodness of the story, then does that follow that we can't judge the goodness of God?
No.
That doesn't follow?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think so. And that part of my notes is going to be an argument for why does a biblical divine determinist, what are the factors that lead to him concluding that God is a good God?
I'm imagining a bad author writing a story that I'm a part of, I'm not going to have any way to know if he's a bad author or good author as well, right?
Well, no, I think it's only the story that you don't have a standpoint to be able to judge. But I do think that you might have a standpoint. I mean, just you begin to see patterns, and so you begin to suspect, and you could come to a relatively confident conclusion. I'm stuck in a story by a bad author. That this author is an evil guy. I think that's possible.
Okay.
Now, we're not... Yeah. But we'll talk about that, about the nature of that knowledge and the nature of that conclusion. But, yeah, I think we can have compelling reasons for believing that the author of this reality is a good...
So the answer isn't just shut up and get on with it. And, you know, don't worry about it. Just get on with life. That's not the answer. Because we can't know whether or not God is...
Right. That's not my answer. Okay. No, I think we can have real confidence that we are in a created reality that's being created by a... I think we can even come to the conclusion that it's a perfectly good author, and therefore can trust our outcome to a perfectly good author. So we're off until 1:30?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Seeing as... a world and all of reality is created to the greater glory of God. On the one hand, that could seem to some people that can seem like a rather selfish view. But on the other hand, if God is nothing but goodness, it is ultimately all that is good in life, then that would make sense that everything would be to glorify him.
Right. Yeah, that's a great question, because that's a common mistake I'm hearing in the criticism I'm hearing in especially the younger generation, is that if they hear my perspective on biblical divine determinism, their perspective is, wow, what kind of egomaniac is God that he wrote a whole book with him as the center of it? But again,
you didn't even ask that question.
Again, that's the prerogative of God being God. I mean, that it self-centeredness is only morally problematic if you're not the center. But if you are the center, self-centeredness makes all the sense in the world. So is it self-centered of God to make the whole story about him? Yeah, it is. But then who else can be the center except the author of this story, who's writing it as an act of some kind of self-expression to give expression to himself. Now, frankly, we kind of rather glibly think, well, that would, you know, we would never do that. Well, what is a novel?
Yeah, art is self-expression.
What is all art except self-expression? Is that self-centered? Well, in a way, yeah.
But what else could it be?
But what else could it be? Exactly. So, it's self-centered, but not in any way that is really incriminating, I think. It just, that's the nature of a creative act. Is a creative act is coming out of me, myself, to be an expression of myself and to reflect who I am.
And I do have one other question, that there are possibly people out there like Judas who by being evil, who by committing evil acts and eventually being condemned, further the story. The thought of being, maybe possibly being one of those evil characters is, I think, the most disturbing thought that I've ever had. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be another Judas.
Mm-hmm. And it ought to be a disturbing thought. I mean, that's exactly how we should respond to it. I remember, you know, one of the real crises, spiritual crises for me early on was, how do I deal with these doubts I have about whether I really belong to God or not? And I remember the day when I was kind of contemplating all this, and I found myself, much to my surprise, deciding, well, if I am going to go to, at that point, I believed in the classical traditional view of hell, if I am going to go to hell, it would only be because it's right that I go to hell. And I really don't want that, but I wouldn't want him to do the wrong thing. I wouldn't want it to be all wrong. He has to do what he has to do, and I really am okay with that. And I surprised myself. I really shocked myself that I could be I'm not sure the word is sanguine, but as accepting of that as I was. And then the next thought came into my mind, that must be what belief is. I mean, to have that kind of perspective and that kind of attitude, where on earth would that come from except God is making me into the kind of person who he's not going to send to hell? And that became a very significant source of confidence for me that God was at work in me. Because that was miraculous. That a human being could be accepting, could embrace that perspective. So I think that's where we ultimately need to get to.
You would trust that God would do justice. You wouldn't want him to do anything else but justice, even if it actually meant a personal destruction.
Exactly. Because it's that Copernican revolution going on. I used to be the center of the universe, and all of a sudden, much to my surprise, God has become the center of the universe. And where did that come from? Okay.